Wow, you're stateside for a while.
It's 3 weeks in total.
Jesus.
10 days of business and 10 days of pleasure, so to say.
So, Dina, can you say pleasure so I can record that?
Why?
No reason.
No reason. Yeah.
Oh, what just happened?
Young man, there's no need to feel down, I said. Young man, pick yourself off the ground. Young man, 'cause you're in a new town, there's no need to be unhappy. Young man, there's a place you can go, I said. Young man, when you're short on your dough, you can stay there. And I'm sure you will find many ways to have a good time. It's fun to stay at the YMCA. It's fun to stay at the YMCA. They have everything for you men to enjoy. You can hang out with all the boys. YMCA. It's fun to stay at the YMCA. They can get yourself clean. You can have a good meal. You can do whatever you feel. Young man, are you listening to me? I said, young man, who do you want to be?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Vassals of Kingsgrave, an offshoot of a podcast of Ice and Fire. Today we're continuing our series of episodes covering serial killers. We've previously done in-depth analyses of Jack the Ripper, H.H. Holmes, amongst others. But today we decided, partly as a result of not being able to agree on who to cover in depth, to do a kind of roundtable approach where the podcast hosts would discuss briefly, but with a bit of colour, their proposed serial killers, and potentially, if we all like one of them, we can take it forward to a full-length podcast. So my name is Ina 007. I'll be your host for today. I am also joined by Matt.
Hey, it's Marley on the forums.
And by Thomas.
Hi, FT Ward on the forums.
And I guess the only other thing it remains for us to say is that obviously we're discussing these things and podcasts are essentially entertainment, but even though we may laugh and joke at some points, we would like to emphasize our respect and sympathy for the victims and their families, and just to sort of underline the fact that although many of us take an interest in serial killers, we should never forget the victims of those crimes. So we've decided to approach this roundtable in linear order. I'm sort of mirroring our Song of Ice and Fire linear rereads. So I think that brings us to Matt. Matt, do you want to take it away with your proposed serial killer?
Sure. So, actually, to throw a wrench in the whole linear thing, I'm going to start it off like this. In a 2014 letter to the Journal of Neuropsychiatry, there was a case outline that started with, a 20-year-old man was admitted after he became increasingly agitated and showed erratic behaviors at home. Starting about 5 weeks before his admission, on initial evaluation, he seemed guarded, internally preoccupied. He gave brief responses and had prolonged latency of speech. His thought process was disrupted, apparently due to lack of attention. He had no significant previous psychiatric history. He had been using alcohol and marijuana occasionally, which, if he admits to it, it's a lot. And a family history of bipolar disorder was present. Letter was called Clinical Lycanthropy, Delusional Misidentification of the, quote, self.
So lycanthropy?
Lycanthropy is a DSM disorder that's really? Associated with schizophrenic, bipolar, and other psychiatric disorders, where a person will exhibit actions of an animal. Lycan is wolf. But it's not limited to wolf. They can exhibit, you know,
bird-like.
Yeah, so it's a thing.
I did not know that lycanthropy was an actual clinical.
Yep. It's a... Yeah, like I said, it's like a representation disorder or something like that. I forget what it's called. I should have written that down. Anyway. So, in 1590, a similar letter was brought to be sold on Fleet Street in London. George Boers carried it out of Holland as it was translated from High Dutch, and it began like this. A true discourse, declaring the damnable life and death of one Stube Peter, a most wicked sorcerer who, in the likeness of a wolf, committed many murders, continuing his devilish practice 25 years, killing and devouring men, women, and children, who for the same fact was taken and executed the 31st of October, passed in the town of Bedburg, later to be known as Bedburg, near the city of Cologne, or Cologne, in Germany. You see, Peter Stube, also known as Peter Stump, Stobe, and Griswold of various first names, started practicing dark magic, necromancy, and sorcery, making him an easy at the age of 12, making him an easy target for the devil who would eventually visit Peter. Seeing a vehicle that would be easy to sow chaos and make, quote, mischief against man in the guise of an animal. So the devil met Peter on a dark, stormy night in the dark, deep woods, I would suppose, and offered him a belt that would turn the wearer into a, quote, greedy, devouring wolf, strong and mighty, with eyes great and large, which in the night sparkled like unto brands of fire, a mouth great and wide, with most sharp and cruel teeth, a huge body and mighty paws, and no sooner should he put off that same girdle, but presently he should appear as his former in shape, according to the proportion of a man, as if he'd never been changed.
Did this person actually exist, or is this a fairy tale?
So the pamphlet that I'm reading from is a Dutch translation that was found in British archive, like in the early 1800s, but that was brought, that was made in 1590.
So 1590 is like current to his life, right? This is not like something that was written decades or century after his life. This is kind of the actual pamphlet was something.
So he was killed in 1589, and the pamphlet was written 1590.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's within living memory, if you want to call it.
So it's at least as accurate as the H.H. Holmes journalism, I would say.
Yeah, basically.
So Peter was on board with this and planned on exacting a bloody revenge to any person who'd wronged him, saying, quote, he would never rest till he had plucked out their throats and teared their joints asunder. Peter's public face was quite different. Being a decently wealthy farmer, he would stroll the streets of Cologne or Cologne, Bedburg, and Cyperdet, which I didn't get a... It's C-P-E-R-A-D-T. I don't know what town that is. And he'd be smiling and greeting those who had savagely lost a loved one or soon would. If any lady caught his eyes, he would wait for them to leave the city gates, where he'd ravish them, Wolfie style. After a couple years, he had, quote... He had murdered 13 young
children. By rabbits, you mean sex, right? You don't mean something.
No, like tearing out their throats. After a couple years, he had murdered 13 young children. Two goodly young women, big with child, tearing the children out of their wombs in a most bloody and savage. And after ate their hearts, panting hot and raw, which he counted dainty morsels and best agreeing to his appetite.
Yeah, but how do they know? How did he like eat them and then go and tell someone? I just ate a beating heart. It's very much my appetite.
I like the quotes where he's quoting the devil and stuff.
Yeah, so you know, this all got out of him. You know, we'll get to it later, but you know, he's found out and put to torture, and that's where all this information comes from. So this is another quote. Thus, this damnable Stube Peter lived the term of 25 years, unsuspected to be the author of so many cruel and unnatural murders, in which time he had destroyed and spoiled an unknown number of men, women, and children, sheep, lambs, goats, and other cattle. Here's another quote. So great was the joy he took therein that he accounted no day spent in pleasure wherein he had not shed some blood. So if this wasn't bad already, he had the hots for a certain little lady.
No.
And quote, committed most wicked incest with her, a most gross and vile sin, far surmounting adultery or fornication, though the least of the three doth drive the soul into hellfire. Oh, and he also got a daughter by his...
God, he's like Krasta, except it's like, that's disgusting.
And I didn't mention that he was also boning his sister.
Oh, but why didn't the daughter run away, or the sister? Like, they're not they're not sort of like Austrian prisoners in sheds or cellars or whatever.
Not that I can find out, but despite all this boning of family members, he was relatively wealthy and charming, and started with an affair with one Catherine Trompin, also known as Trompe or Trump. According to the pamphlet, even the devil sent him a concubine, who he kept for 7 years. The pamphlet's pretty weird.
Where did he even get the time for this? Like, you know, between ravishing the pregnant women and, you know...
running the farm.
Eating / fucking the goats, and then shagging his sister, and, like, you know, the devil mistress, and...
He's well scheduled. Like, he's like... Oh, did I mention Peter was also interested in his son?
Oh, what? He was fucking the son?
No, so one day they went to a walk in the forest where Peter said he needed to pee, so he walked off, put on his belt, and in the likeness of a wolf he encountered his own son, and there most cruelly slew him, which done, he presently ate the brains out of his head as a most savory and dainty, delicious mean to staunch his greedy appetite. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of a long quote, but it's a really good segue. By which means, the inhabitants of Colin, Bedburg, and Sipperberg, whatever that means, Cologne, Bedburg, and whatever that other town is, seeing themselves so grievously endangered, plagued, and molested by this greedy and cruel wolf, who wrought continual harm and mischief, insomuch that few or none durst to travel to or from those places without good provision of defense, and all for fear of this devouring and fierce wolf, for oftentimes the inhabitants found the arms and legs of dead men, women, and children scattered up and down the fields, to their great grief and vexation of heart, knowing the same to be done by the strange and cruel wolf, whom by no means they could take or overcome, so that if any man or woman missed their child, they were out of hope ever to see them alive again. Okay.
There's probably some real life guy who just got a bad rep, and then they kind of made a witch out of him.
Yeah, I'm curious where this is going at the end.
You know, ignorant peasants. It's a bit Beating the Beast. Oh, let's go and, you know, let's go and kill the beast. It's just a bit, ugh. Anyway, carry on.
Here we go. Peter's days were numbered, though. One day he spied some young girls playing in a field and went to tear out one of their throats. But because she was wearing some kind of tough collar, he was unable to. And then came the cow.
Let me get this straight. The guy who's managed to, like, rip babies out of their pregnant mother's wombs and is shagging a woman sent to him by Satan is somehow stopped in his tracks by a rather stiff collar.
Yep.
Ooh,
but don't worry, it gets better. So not only was the collar good, but... And then came the cows. Apparently the feeding cows charged the wolf and chased him out as they were afraid that he was going to attack one of their young ones. I should note that this story came from a brewer by the name of Master Tice Artin of Puddle Wharf, London, who was related to the child. So I don't know if Puddle Wharf is a thing still or not.
Actually, yeah, Puddle Docks is, I used to live in a city very close to that, but definitely is still a thing.
Are all German people brewers, by the way, or is that just...
I don't know. I mean, this guy was living in London, so...
I mean, there's a lot of beer consumed in Germany and in London, so...
Okay. So the village people were up in arms and went out to hunt for the wolf.
Were the village people up in arms? Were they singing in formation in cowboy hats and ready green headdresses?
They're all doing wise, because all their arms are off.
Up in arms, but on the dance floor.
We know the music that we're going to have at the beginning of this now. That's good.
The Teen Wolf music, please.
Mashed up with YMCA. I can make that happen.
Okay, so the dogs had the wolf scent and cornered the beast. When the hunters came upon the dogs, they saw the wolf change into a man that they knew. A man from town. Peter fucking Stubb. Peter was to be tortured on the rack, but before it even started, he voluntarily confessed all his crimes that had taken taken place over the span of 25 years. He confessed his belt he got from the devil. Conveniently, he had tossed it after he was apprehended, and it was never found. As great collateral damage, his daughter/baby mama and Catherine Trump, maybe, were charged as accessories to murder. They were to be burned at the stake. But Peter, he had to pay.
Wait. These girls who are victims of rape and incest are going to get burnt at the stake?
Yep.
Oh, you got to love medieval justice.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, just wait. So Peter had to pay. The judgments were passed on the 28th of October, 1589, and as luck would have it, on Halloween of that year, the punishments were delivered. Quote, Stew Peter, as principal malefactor, was judged to have his body laying on a wheel, and with red-hot burning pincers in 10 several places to have the flesh pulled from his bones. After that, his legs and arms to be broken with a wooden axe or hatchet. Afterward, to have his head struck from his body, and then have his carcass burned to ashes.
This seems a little bit overkill. It sounds like it went like how they were trying to kill Rasputin. You know, let's shoot him, then let's drown him in a river, then let's hang, draw, and quarter him, you know.
Yeah, I'm not familiar, I guess, with how common, this kind of execution was. Is this, completely atypical, or is this the kind of thing that was commonly done to... Does anyone know? I don't know.
I mean, I don't know. I just said it definitely is a death worthy of George writing it. In the town of Bedburg, erected a pole with the wheel that he was broken on mounted on it. Above that was a carved face of a wolf, and at the very top was Peter Stude's fucking head. As a warning to any would-be sorcerers who thought that they could murder for 25 years with impunity in the town of Bedburg, Peter Stube has another name, the Werewolf of Bedburg.
Very cool. Well, why did they, if they really thought he was doing all this rampaging, why did they wait for 25 years to go after him? You know, why did he wait for the fortuity of a starched collar and a bunch of hormonal cows?
I'm very curious what the reality was. The villagers have
mobbed up and sort of gone after him. Yeah, exactly. I'd love to know the real story.
Yeah, so you can read it in the London chapbook of 1590. It's called The Damnable Life and Death of Stude Peter.
I'm also curious as to how you came across this. This is an absolute nugget of brilliance.
So I try to write it in kind of a fun vollop kind of thing.
Yeah, it was very vollopy. But where did you come across the story, Matt?
I think literally it was just ancient serial killers. I was looking up something about Bathory, and this kind of was also see Werewolf Bedburg. I was well, let me get some of that.
Yeah, the medieval serial killers are brilliant because there's no real facts, and it's all hugely sensationalized. And I get the impression with lots of them that they were probably just people living on the fringes of society who got absolutely,
If you read the translation of the pamphlet, it is kind of a moral story. You know, it ends with, "This gentle reader, I have set down the true discourse of this wicked man, Stude Peter, which I desire to be a warning to all sorcerers and witches, which unlawfully follow their own devilish imagination to the utter ruin and destruction of their souls eternally, from which wicked and damnable practice I beseech God keep all good men, and from the cruelty of their wicked hearts. Amen."
Yeah, so, don't fuck your daughter because then hormonal cows might try and stampede you.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but I mean, some of the language obviously is a little weird, but I like to quote as much as I could from this.
Yeah, no, it's an absolute joy.
Yeah, I just feel like, was there an actual serial killer active, or was this just people died and this guy was a scapegoat? Because I don't obviously buy the details of the story. No offense to anyone that has a magic belt, but...
Do you have a magic belt?
I have a belt that I like a lot, but I don't think it's magic.
Are you trying to tell me that Magic Johnson isn't actually magic? That's so sad.
So, yeah, that was Peter Stubb.
Okay.
And literally, a couple things was like, Catherine Trump. I was like, really?
Yeah.
Really?
Do we know that he definitely existed?
We don't. I don't think. No. It's so, a couple places that I read, and I can't quote the citation, but, it was, that area was in the Prussian Wars around that time. So they think that it was either, like, records were either destroyed during the Prussian War or during World War II when that area was heavily bombed.
Yeah, so I was just looking at the wiki. Not that that's, like, a great source, but it seems like that area at that time was, like, a war between Protestants and Catholics, and that this might have been just a giant trumped-up political trial, and all kind of atrocities were kind of a...
Yeah, and also, I feel wartime and sort of disruption are great sources of, especially in this period, like, what is the law?
I try to, like, stay away from the wiki and go to, like, the original source of the translated pamphlet. So, I read some other articles on, like, you know, true crime websites and stuff like that, but just kind of get, like, you know, how they interpreted the pamphlet, but it all seems pretty much the same.
And it looks like it was part of Big Top Scooby-Doo, the direct-to-video movie, so that should be interesting.
Excuse me?
I don't know, in the popular culture section it says the direct-to-video Big Top Scooby-Doo uses a portion of the woodcut of his execution.
Oh, let me send you the woodcut. Hold on. I don't know if anyone speaks or reads German, but...
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
But this will probably be like medieval German or something, right, rather than contemporary.
Right, it's like old English, you know.
The Werewolf of Bedford.
High Dutch, probably.
Yeah, that is one messed up. I love the villagers with the kind of clubs going after him as well.
I like the chicken, or...
Yeah, the rooster just like hanging out. It's like... About to get pounced on by the wolf, but still like, I don't care. Like, and then the guy hanging is doing his best Robb Stark impression.
I'm assuming the heroic cows are just off screen, I'm assuming, here somewhere.
I'm sad not to see them. Definitely.
Yeah. Oh my god. Like, hold on.
The world needs more heroic cows. Why has there not been a cow superhero? I mean, the DC Marvel universes are so rich. There's got to be one.
I think there are.
Okay, so hold on. This is the quote from the pamphlet that I didn't use. The wolf could not pierce the collar of the child's coat, being high and very well stiffened, and clothes clasped around her neck. And therewithal, the sudden great cry of the rest of the children, which escaped so amazed, the cattle feeding by, that fearful to be robbed of their young, they altogether came running against the wolf with such force that he was presently compelled to let go of his hold and run away to escape the danger of their horns.
This is just brilliant.
There's a bat cow, by the way.
There's a what?
A bat cow in DC Comics.
Oh my god.
Damian Wayne, who is the son of Bruce Wayne, has a pet bat cow.
Oh, for heaven's sake. You're taking the piss now.
No, he saved him, and then he became a vegan.
I'm Googling this. It's got to be true.
And then he brought him into the League of Shadows and trained him.
He avoided the League of Shadows. I think he lives on Wayne Manor. I'm not sure where he's at right now. But...
Oh, my God. Bat Cow and Robin? Who is this?
Oh my god, it's an actual thing!
Yeah, it was a pretty big deal.
Jesus Christ!
There's an image of Batman patting him on the cheek saying, Bat Cow. Bat Cow saying, foo. Oh my god.
After the events of Robin's death, Bat Cow and Robin's dog felt a great loss in morale. Alfred Pennyworth and Nightwing had to take care of the cow. Bat cow complete with cape spent time on a Wayne owned dairy farm. It was there the cow encountered the cosmic power to forever people. Oh, sorry.
Oh, sorry.
This podcast is the gift that keeps on giving.
It really is.
I feel I'm gonna lower the tone, or maybe raise the tone into boredom with my excerpt. Oh my god, there's a picture of Robin riding Batcow over a fence. Yeah. Okay, anything else on the werewolf dude?
That's all I got.
Well, in the spirit of Volpiness, 1865! Severin Antonovich Klozowski is born in Poland. He's at the age of 14 apprenticed to the surgeon, Moshe Rapoport, where he learned cutting-edge scientifically sound techniques such as bloodletting with leeches.
Oh.
He also got married to his first wife. But then, as many of his people, he emigrated to London in the year 1888. And indeed moved to Whitechapel, which, as we all know from our Jack the Ripper studies, was a poverty-stricken district of East London with a very large Polish German immigrant community. So not unsurprising he ended up there. Once there, he married again another Polish woman called Lucy Badawowski, and had two children with her, but basically was a bit of a scoundrel and took a bunch of mistresses, including one whose surname he appropriated. So he restyles himself as George Chapman. So at this point, he's got two wives, and he basically takes on a succession of mistresses, and poisoned three to death. Those are the ones we know about. So the first one was Mary Isabella Spink, who he poisoned in 1897. The second was Bessie Taylor, who died in 1901. And the third was Maud Marsh in 1902. So basically all three were given this poison, which is called tartar emetic, which he got from a pharmacy in Hastings, which is away from London, and would have caused a death as painful as that from arsenic. So he was caught because when the third mistress died, it was seen as a suspicious murder. And they kind of realized that she died of poisoning, dug up the other two mistresses and realized they'd died too. But apparently in those days, you could only put one death on an indictment. So there wasn't actually like technically a serial killer type indictment. So he was charged with the death of the final mistress.
How is that possible?
Yeah,
like after Jack the Ripper?
Yeah, I know. Weird, huh? So anyway, he was hanged for killing that Maud Marsh at the age of 27. So in this young life, he'd managed to do all that. And then he was hung on April 7th,
1903. Hanged.
Hanged. So,
remember, you hung the pheasant, you hanged a peasant.
Hanged the man, exactly. Hanged the peasant. So what I find fascinating about this guy is, I mean, obviously he was a serial killer by poisoning, which is horrific in and of itself, but obviously the fact that he was active at the same time as Jack the Ripper, or was he? I mean, he was in the East End at the same time as Jack the Ripper. So the reason that he's famous is because Inspector Abilene apparently told the policeman who arrested him, "You've got Jack the Ripper at last." And basically this was all based on the fact that Abilene had interviewed his London wife, so the bigamist's wife, who told Abilene that he went out for long walks at night, which seems really, like, you know, not particularly incriminating as evidence. So anyway, there's a case for and a case against him being the Jack the Ripper murderer. But we know he's a serial killer regardless, right? So the case for is that he was definitely violent and misogynistic. He beat his wives and mistresses. This is very well known. He obviously did arrive in London in 1888, just as the murder started. And curiously, he actually left London for the United States for a short period, which is when the Jack the Ripper killings ended. When he was in the US, he married yet a third woman, bigamously or trigamously, or whatever you want to call it at that point, called Lucy Kozlowski. And apparently there was this incident where he forced her onto her bed in their house and was strangling her. And he only stopped because a customer walked into the shop that was next to their bed, the house part of their setup. So he stopped, but he did have a knife under the pillow. And apparently he boasted to neighbors he was going to kill her and even how he was going to dispose of the body.
Wait a minute.
So he's evidently...
They were boning next to the shop entrance?
Well, no, I think, you know, in those days it's like if you had like a house where the front parlor is a shop and the back parlor is kind of where you live. I think that's pretty normal setup in those days. So he's obviously a nasty piece of shit. He obviously did, you know, murder a lot of his mistresses. But not, it's kind of like the motive is probably mental illness because he didn't really inherit anything from any of them. It's not like H.H. Holmes where he was doing it for insurance money. I think he got 500 quid from one of them, which in fairness would have been a lot of money in those days, but it's not like a consistent financial motive. And obviously very sexually violent. But for me... And I think, like, most people don't think he's a serious Jack the Ripper suspect, despite the kind of alleged Abilene quote. Because it just seems weird. The JTR killings were before the poisonings, and it just feels weird to sort of de-escalate. You know, what we know of the Jack the Ripper killings doesn't feel like you would then start off 10 years later with this very sort of mild-mannered domestic poisoning. And also, the murders happened so quickly after he got to Whitechapel. It just seems that to have committed those murders, you sort of needed intimate knowledge of Whitechapel streets to appear and disappear and to know English. So it kind of feels like he's not really a sensible suspect. But I kind of, the reason I kind of picked him is because I kind of like the social history of that period, obviously, so I'm attracted to that. But because I think it's fascinating that, in a sense, because people try and make him, or potentially make him a Jack the Ripper killer, I just wonder if we're in danger of overlooking the actual victims that we really know about. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not enough in some sick way that he killed these poor three women. At minimum, he may have killed other mistresses we don't know about. Like, we have to sort of make him more interesting only because he's potentially Jack the Ripper. So I think it kind of says something interesting about us as a society. So, yeah, that's my candidate.
Do you think that, like, I don't know, in the scope of him being Jack the Ripper, he did poisoning instead of, like, brutally stabbing because he had a relationship with these women, more than just seeing them as, you know, streetwalkers?
I mean, there's no evidence that George Chapman ever used prostitutes or... There's something that's so specific...
I mean, he was definitely a womanizer and...
Yeah, exactly, but that tells me... That almost, like, is a different profile. Like, for me, he's almost more in the H.H. Holmes, the sort of the charmer, the guy who has no problem getting women to sort of shack up with him.
Still has a big problem with women.
Yeah, more like a confidence trickster who also happens to be sort of very sexually violent. I mean, not that I'm like a trained behavioral sort of profiler or anything, but I'm sure it's definitely possible. And I think it is controversial, isn't it? Like, there probably is sort of controversy around... Do serial killers always have the same modus operandi, or can they de-escalate? And in the same way that...
Six podcasts, we're pretty well to make professional.
Well, it just feels like that was one of the arguments used about the Black Dahlia killer that we were proposing. And, you know, could you go from this just one very particular, quite brutal, but very carefully staged murder and then go and do other different types of murder? You know, like when his son, Steve Hodell, is trying to pin his father to lots of other types of murder. And we were like, but why would he just change so much? But I guess maybe it is possible.
I mean, but like you said, I think it develops, and you saw the development of, like, how each murder was more brutal in the Jack the Ripper escalation, whereas if this guy just keeps on poisoning, you know, it doesn't seem like not only they're on the same progression, it's just like they're not the same person.
And even then it feels a bit inconsistent. Like the whole sexually violent thing, I could understand if you were just strangling the woman each time, but to then, I don't know, there's something about poisoning, like going to Hastings, which isn't that close to London, buying the poison, sort of feels almost very cool and calm, whereas the kind of strangling the women on the bed feels more like the crime of passion. So even within the George Chapman description and stuff that we definitely know that both of these things happen with him, there feels like a contradiction. So maybe there isn't a contradiction between him doing the poisonings and being Jack the Ripper. I don't know.
So he's...
They say poisoning's a woman's weapon or a unit.
He's very... how old is he when he gets to London, emigrates to England?
Well, he dies in 1902 at 27. So, 92, he's 17. So, he would have been...
Like,
I mean, that's too young. That's too young, isn't it?
He seems too young. I mean, I've looked at him not... I can't remember last time, but, like, he seems very young when he's... In 1888, he seems like he's unlikely to be particularly fluent in English, right? And we, you know...
Is that why he misspelled Jews?
And we have some eyewitness testimony and ear witness testimony, and how reliable it is, who knows. But to me, a 23-year-old just off the boat doesn't fit. And again, I probably have bias on what I think or who I think Jack the Ripper was. But it doesn't fit my picture of who I imagine. And then to be poisoning wives, it's like in the 1890s, right? So maybe like
the late 1890s.
10 years later. It doesn't fit. And again, I'm not an expert. I pretend I'm an expert on these podcasts, but I don't really know serial killer psychology very well. But it doesn't fit for my, again, biased picture of what I imagine or who
me
I
neither.
Imagine Jack was. But again, I'm happy to revisit Jack the Ripper anytime you guys want to do anything else, Victorian or whatever.
Well, and I guess the point is I didn't want to revisit him, but I just think it's interesting how anyone remotely misogynistic and violent in that era gets... It's like all these really interesting side cases get sucked into this vortex of Jack. And actually, these men and these victims deserve recognition on their own.
It is strange, right? It's like, do they just assume, like, every wife beater or wife killer or mistress killer was, like, Jack the Ripper? Because every gentleman, like, of that age was, like, perfectly civil to their wife.
Yeah. I think there is a tendency to look at, like, violent misogynists and just put them all in the same basket where there's probably quite a bit of variance in how you're violent and how you're misogynistic, but again, I'm not an expert.
I would think like almost every, well, from like what I've read in books and like, you know, read from history, it just seems like almost anyone, like even in America up until recently, it was like legal to rape your wife. Like, so
in India it still is.
Okay, well, but it, like, I just feel like looking back and be like, oh yeah, that was misogynistic to a woman. We can say that with like pretty like certainty. Back then it was like, what do you mean? I'm like a loving, doting husband, and yes, I hit my wife every now and then. But
yeah, I mean, in fact, the Galsworthy novel, The Forsyte Saga, which is set around this period, is exactly built on that premise, which is a sort of upper middle class family, and the husband is a prosperous lawyer, marries a wife who doesn't really love him, and just enforces his desire to have a son by sort of raping her. And at the time it was very controversial, because technically he wasn't raping her, because there was no such thing as marital rape. So I guess we have to be careful not to sort of, I don't know, we have to remember the context. But to me, the George Chapman case seems like he had no problem relating to women, charming women, living with women. Whereas Jack the Ripper, it seems to me, had such a kind of warped...
he had a vendetta against women.
Yeah, like, I don't think Jack the Ripper, it sort of by day, was you know, chatting up women in pubs and getting a new mistress. He was so way beyond his ability to sort of view them actually as people. So it's just a category difference. From my perspective. Plus, you know, I like Aaron Kosminski for Jack the Ripper, so like you, F. Thomas, I have like confirmation bias. Like anything that's away from him, I freely admit, you know. But yeah, anyway, that was just my guy. Do you want to move on to yours, Thomas?
Sure, I feel less prepared than you guys, but so, my case is unlikely to be a serial killing. It's the case of the Somerton Man, or Tamam Shud. And it was the body of a 45-ish to 50-year-old man discovered on Somerton Beach in Adelaide, South Australia, on
Adelaide
on December 1st, 1948. And the mystery surrounding his cause of death and his identity is kind of, I think, one of Australia's biggest kind of unsolved crimes. But Somerton Man was believed to be poisoned, though it's not clear for sure whether that was the cause of death or not. And his identity has never been determined. He was had all the labels of his clothing were removed, and his identification was not present on his body. I guess that could have been stolen or something. I'm doing a horrible job. So
I don't know much about this, but it sounded like either it was a mob hit or some kind of intelligence agency, like, you know, blackout, where it's just like everything was erased. Like, that's why. But you said his name. Did you figure out his name?
No. Well, there's a website that I've been looking at, tamamshud.blogspot, I think it's called. Yep. And they seem to have centered on a guy named. So their current suspect for him is a man named Pavel Ivanovich Fedosimov. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that right. And he was a major in the KGB. And I guess I should start with that Australia, South Australia, 1948. It's kind of the center of British defense as far as atomic research and rocket and missile technology. There's a base called the Woomera Protected Area in South Australia, where, because Britain itself is kind of heavily populated, densely populated, and not a lot of space, they've kind of sent their post-World War II rocket research to kind of Australia, where obviously you have lots of room as well.
Oh, so that's like their Los Alamos? Like,
correct.
Where they can set the atomic bombs and, like, no one's around to hear them?
Exactly. And if you know anything, and I know Bina knows quite a bit about British intelligence and defense in the 1940s and 50s, that it's highly infiltrated by the Soviet Union. And there is evidence that that there's lots of Soviet spies in South Australia, and whether this guy is one of them or whether it's connected, his death is connected to that or not, is highly in question, but it's certainly an interesting aspect of the case.
The only thing I find intriguing about that is there evidence of other KGB hits where, you know, they put the whole Tamamshud thing is because they put the last, is it This Is Ended, which is the last line of the Rubaiyat by Omar Khayyam?
Correct.
They put this very beautiful poem.
Sorry, what was it?
In his pocket.
Yeah, so in his fob pocket, after his death, and actually, I think several months after his death, the police kind of give all the evidence to a professor at a college in Adelaide to kind of give a second look at everything, because they're kind of stumped. And inside the fob pocket of his pants, this professor finds a rolled up piece of paper which says the words Tamam Shud, which is Persian for, I think, kind of it is ended or the end, kind of. And
yep, I think you're right.
It ends up, it's torn out or cut out of the back page, the last words from a book of poetry, Persian poetry, called the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. And I would think it's more likely he put it in his pants than someone else did, but whether that kind of leads you to believe that the words...
But it's spooky, though, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like, why would he put it in his pants?
Well, if it was a suicide, maybe.
The cutting out the labels and the cutting out...
Yeah, why would... Yeah.
I don't know.
So, and then eventually, I'm doing a horrible job telling the story, but eventually the actual book that he cut the page out of, or someone removed the section out of, is found in a car a few close to where his body is found. And inside that book, there's also phone numbers, plural, I believe, and a what could be a code. There's a series of English letters which could be well be a cipher, a code, which again has led people to look at the espionage angle as a possibility of his death.
Yeah, like to me this is much more of a mystery than a serial killer, although it's not as if Adelaide is without its serial killers. It's like the serial killer capital of the world.
Is it?
Yeah, like my best friend Curly's from Adelaide, and yeah.
Oh, hey, Curly.
Place is riddled with serial killers. I've actually been to Glen Elg as well, which is a beautiful beach where his body was found. It's really stunning.
So
I would love to do this as like a full-blown podcast and read lots of books and do lots of research, because I think it is so fascinating. And the social history of Adelaide at the time, the British presence, even though it's independent, and then the KGB angle is just... It just links into so many things in which I'm fascinated.
Yeah. And I do that horrible job.
I don't want to anger any Putin supporters or future overlords. So you guys can do that. I feel like if it was professional espionage, like, wouldn't they just, like, tear his face off or something? Like, it just seems like a lot of overkill to, like, remove tags and, like, remove everything, but, like...
Unless they were trying to send a message to someone, I guess.
I think the expectation is he had removed his own tags if he's a spy. That he's trying not to be identified himself. the fact that he dies is not part of his plan, obviously.
And I just finished a book, called Last Hope Island, where the British were training spies for World War II, and, like, a dude would show up with, like, in a suit with leather, like, leather shoes from, like, Savile Row, and, like, in Holland, where they haven't had, like, access to leather in forever, and, like, they'd just be like, that guy's a spy.
Yeah, schoolboy era. So what's your theory, Thomas? Do you kind of think it is the espionage kind of angle?
That's the kind of the most fun angle, I guess. The phone number, or one of the phone numbers in the back of the copy of the book of poetry they find, leads them to a nurse who's living just a few blocks from where his body is found. And this guy has some interesting physical characteristics. He's missing some teeth, like genetically, doesn't have incisors. And he is...
Wait a minute, the corpse or the nurse?
I'm sorry, the corpse, the unknown man. He does naturally did not have incisors. And he has some strange ears, and it turns out this nurse, who has like a one-year-old child, this child turns out to grow up not having incisors and having strange ears, and the speculation is possible that the son was his son.
Was she married? Was it like a husband-lover kill?
She says she is married at this time. She's actually not married. She's taken the name of Thompson, but that is not someone she will... She eventually does marry the guy, but she's not currently married to anyone, though she tells the police that she is married. And then kind of genetic testing of the descendants of these people, of the son. So... leads to the father of his father's father having American, they believe, DNA from the kind of the Virginia area of America, I've read. So that would kind of not be a Soviet spy. It could certainly be an American spy. But
does Virginia have different DNA?
Yeah, I think I think there's like American,
it's like a mix between John Rolfe and like Pocahontas.
Well, I think there's like American Indian as well, DNA from tribes there. So, and there's no guarantee that he is the father of that child, but it does lead to a lot of interesting questions. And it is kind of an interesting look at the guy. Really wasn't super familiar with post-war Australia. And it is an interesting look, I think, into that world.
Oh, it's super racist. I know that.
Isn't it racist to say that it was super racist?
I guess so, but it could also be true.
Yeah. Just because you think like, something
civil rights in Mississippi.
I would 100% vote for us to go away and do some reading about this and do like a full-blown podcast with some folks on it. I find it fascinating.
Yeah.
So, and I guess it wouldn't be a serial killer one. It would just be like a mystery theater one. We can create an East Strand or something.
There are a few other deaths connected, like with people with the
Yacht
of Omar Khayyam. So could this nurse be like a Black Widow serial killer? I don't think so, but there's at least a sliver of that possibility. I think it's more likely maybe a suicide or an accidental death, but I'm not a doctor, and the doctors there at the time thought it was a poison. And so they couldn't determine what the poison was, and it wasn't really consistent with any poisons that they were aware of, but that was their position.
Because it's fucking Australia. Everything there is poisonous and trying to kill you. Like, he probably stepped on a funnel spider while, like, walking on the beach or something and somehow fell into the water.
I kind of even think maybe, like, positional asphyxia, if you've seen a picture or kind of know his body position, he's leaning up against a wall, and I think maybe he got drunk and fell and ended up in a position where he could not get any oxygen. So I think
are Australians big drinkers? I hadn't heard that.
So the Soviet aspect, I think, is very interesting. There's also, you know, just the whole mystery of it. But it's unlikely to have anything to do with serial killing. But it's something that there is a rabbit hole to go down to if you guys are interested. And I hope you guys did a better job of selling it than I did. So.
No, I'm totally up for doing this.
Let me read a little bit more about it before I dive into, like, a book about it.
Yeah, there's not a ton of books about it, but there's lots of websites and YouTube videos and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But dude, Preston Jacobs makes YouTube videos. I mean, Christ's sake, we make YouTube videos. They're not to be trusted.
Agreed.
We are not to be trusted, 100%.
Oh.
Cool. Well, I think that wraps up this unusually short episode of Battles of Kingsgrave. Been a little taster on some serial killers out there, potentially one of which we'll take forward. If you all have any ideas on who you would like us to cover after the Black Dahlia, H.H. Holmes, and Jack the Ripper, then please let us know on the forums. You can get in touch with us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Just search for Battles of Kingsgrave and you will find us. So with that, it's goodbye from me, being a 007, and thanks to Matt and Thomas.
Thank you.
Sorry, that was my, like, cancer
report. A very special Wolfcast. Don't, you shouldn't smirch the image of Wolfcast with that. That's like a special call sign. Cool, posse out.
Beware, Scott, when the moon is full. Oh, no, not again.
If anyone sees me like this!
Hey man, say, don't be shy if it happens to you.
Hi, Grandpa.
Good morning, Scotty.
It's fun being different if you have a healthy attitude.
Only my friends Boop and Styles know my hairy secret.
I'm feeling hairy and my teeth are mean. I got a weird complexion and I want to smile.
This is going to be super short.
Yeah.
That's fun, though. We should do more short podcasts, actually.
Yeah, the little, like, 30-minute bump podcast. Yeah. I actually kind of like this format of, like, you know, except for the Summerton Men, which I'll look into, that we might be able to drag out to, like, a full hour and a half podcast. I think we got, basically, we went over our things really quickly.
So, Bina, yeah. I've been watching Escape to the Country all afternoon, and I don't understand how I don't own a English cottage.
You know what? I went to visit the Huntington Library today, which is basically in Pasadena, I think. And it's so, the houses are so beautiful. I want to move to Pasadena. So I'll swap you an English country cottage if you get me a Marin County out. Oh dear. Anyway. So how are you all doing anyway? I haven't spoken to you for a while, Thomas. How's it going?
Super busy. Not great, but...
Hello. Hi, yeah, feel free. No, that's okay. You can do that. Sorry. I'm sitting in a hotel room, so they're coming to fill the ice bucket, which is very kind of them.
First world problems, if I ever heard
of. Yeah, seriously. You're going to have to walk down the hall to the ice machine and fill it up yourself.
Do you need anything for this?
Say pleasure.
It's not a porno.
It could be. Come on.
The maid comes in. Alright.
I'm in a really nice... I'm like in the junior suite of the Ritz-Carlton LA Live.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, so it's all
good. Like, I'm already in pleasure.
I'm all sad. Oh. I mean, it's pathetic, isn't it?
No,
the saddest
it's not
thing to be
pathetic,
sad at, like, the Ritz-Carlton. Where did you go wrong? They brought the wrong brand champagne up. It's been a mess.
Yeah. Well, what can I say? But I'm meeting up with Hannah and Dr. Blood on Tuesday night, so we're meeting up at LA Live and having
say hello
dinner
to everyone.
So that's going
to
be awesome. Yeah. Yeah. No, I really wanted to go, but after my epic 3 week sort of being in America, I couldn't really come back. And then at the end of this month, Kiralee, aforementioned friend who's
hey,
a youth in Adelaide, Land of Zero Colors, and I are going to Dubrovnik for a bit of a sort of Game of Thrones tour.
Nice.
So.
You going to do a VOK on that? Like you did for Ireland?
And that was sad, me just talking to myself. So if one of you wants to come on with me and like I can talk to you about it and you can react, and that sounds slightly less sad, then I'll do that. But yeah, anyway. But it's the anniversary of that. And we've decided next year in April we're going to go to Iceland. So yeah. GAT tours continue.
Did you listen to the oh yeah, you did listen to the Iceland dollop already, right?
Oh, that was so funny. That the Icelandic comedian they had on was just hilarious. Hurrah. Yeah. That was a bunch of fun. Oh, the maid's gone, thank goodness for that.
That bitch. Just listening in on our conversation.
I know, the audacity.
Know your place.
Don't want to hang a peasant. Poor woman. She is very charming. Okay, well, with that, I guess I'll let you guys go.
Alright, nice talking to you guys.
Do you want me to talking. I won't be able to do it till after I'm home, but I can if you want.
Yeah, I'm away next weekend, so the weekend out, it'll be like 2 weeks for me. I think I should be able to get to it if you can get to it before then. That's fine, otherwise I'm eager to make myself sound less stupid, so.
Oh, well, I'll leave it with you. I mean, none of this is time sensitive, so.
And then if you talk to Hannah or Jock or anything, you want to let them know if they have anything they want to record and add 15-20 minutes or something, we'll put that in too.
Cool, okay. Well, if I'm going to be with Hannah on Tuesday and Dr. Blood, then I know she wanted to be on, so what I'll say to her is if she wants to do her sort of 5 to 10 minutes live, we can do reactions around an iPhone and at least, I'm not sure how we'll tape it though. How will we record it? Or maybe if we just arrange 15 minutes with you where you can record it on Tuesday night. I don't know if that's possible.
Probably not a good week for me, but I can do it like in a couple weeks probably.
Okay, cool. I'll let you know. Okay. Alright guys, have a lovely Saturday night.
Yep.
You too. Well.
Bye all.
All right, have fun, guys. Good talking.
Bye.
Bye.